This episode is supported by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla, made for people who are into or build AI and people who develop tech policies. Listen to Mozilla IRL wherever you listen to your podcast.
Welcome to The Expansive Podcast, where we explore the frontiers of personal growth, business innovation, and technology. We believe that growth and progress come from expanding our minds, exploring new possibilities, and embracing change. And in today's pod, we should actually add something to that line, is engaging with super interesting people. And if you're a listener of the pod, you know that we don't often interview people, but when we come across somebody special and somebody who's got a great story, we corner them and force them to come onto the pod, which is exactly what we've done today with Nathan. But before we bring Nathan on, I'm always joined by my co-pilot, Eric, who's got a new haircut. Eric, what's happening there, man?
Listen, I mean, I'm speechless. I don't know, like, why do we start there? Why, you know, of all the different places to start, why are we starting with the haircut?
Because you look great, Eric.
Thank you. Okay, that's, yeah, thank you.
Just take the compliment. Take the compliment. So I have the huge privilege of traveling around the world extensively. And one of the best things besides the food and the new views that you take a look at is you meet new and amazing, interesting people. And it was about 6 months ago or maybe 8 months ago that I met Nathan. And we got introduced by a friend and we hit it off immediately. Lots of ideas, lots of energy, super fit, lots of ambition. And Nathan started telling me stories that I've never heard before, and I thought that would be excellent for us to share on the pod. So Nathan Farugia, welcome to The Expansive.
Thank you for having me. And there was no force required, I can tell you.
No. I was just trying to have a bit of a stab at myself. Nathan, tell us where you are right now and a quick brief, where you're from and what's your small little quick history before we kick straight into the pod.
Okay, so I'm currently in Malta, a small island in the Mediterranean where I'm from. My dad's Maltese, my mother's English. Lived most of my life here, although I've worked around the world, spending more time perhaps in the UK and London and now in the Middle East. I started my career as a physiotherapist. I wanted to reduce my physio bills from all my sports injuries, so I thought I'd do it myself. And eventually sort of became passionate about endurance sports and the mind over matter and all that sort of stuff around how far we can explore what's the human limit. But at the same time, been fortunate to be asked to run organizations for others, both in tech, healthcare, hospitality, and events. And as a CEO, I also realized that a lot of the learning I got from sports could be applied in work and life. So I've been intrigued as a study to figure out what makes people better performers than others. Fortunately, I've been able to jump out of the rat race, as a CEO and started my entrepreneurial life quite recently, call it a midlife crisis, and sort of moved into the business coaching space where I meet, like you, intelligent and interesting people who I like to pick their brains and then apply that knowledge to my other clients and my team, and obviously have a large team of coaches that work with our clients. And so, that's how I earn a living. I'm married with two kids. One is 19 studying law and the other is 17 in college. My wife is very into her own little business, which is personal training. As an ex-Olympian, she has quite a following here in Malta, so that's good for her, and she loves it. Yeah, and that's awesome. That's basically it. And I try and keep
Thank
fit.
Thank you. Yes, I know, I can see you're very fit. That's the first thing I noticed about you. You're super, super conditioned, but there seems to be a correlation between an Eric. Eric, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I can't believe it. When I graduated in 2007, I graduated as a physiotherapist. And I was in practice for probably about 8 years. I did mainly sort of ICU work for a long time and then headed up a step-down facility. And then at some point I was like, I don't know what your journey was, how you went from that in transitioning into other things. But for me, it was just like, I couldn't walk with old ladies anymore because I ended up being in a step-down, just dealing with hip replacements and knee replacements. And I was just like, this isn't for me anymore. What was that transition for you? What sparked for you that you were like, okay, physio is done. I need to move on to something else.
Well, it was a gentle transition in different ways. I think, you know, I left university to work for the government hospital, which is typical of what happens here, and realized that I couldn't make change in such a bureaucratic environment. So I became an entrepreneur and I set up my own clinic, which became two, which became three, which became four. And I really enjoyed the entrepreneurial journey. But at the same time, I was also getting my ikigai because I was actually helping more and more people through the techniques that that we developed and used. Through my sports, I got to pick and choose my patients, which were mostly sports injuries and back injuries, which was much more dynamic. You see results quicker, so it's more motivating. But I ended up spending too much time then sort of running the business and not being hands-on. And that's when I started to explore the leadership side. And so I went and did my MBA, you know, got my business studies, started to look into, you know, more leadership roles. And one of my clinics was actually in part of a five-star hotel, spa thing, resort. And I eventually became the general manager of the spa through being there and showing good leadership. And the business helped me grow as a leader and learn new skills and realize that actually I could make more of an impact by leading others than by doing it myself.
Yeah.
It's not a skill everybody has. I mean, it's obviously something that's innate to you to be able to do that. One of the stories that I remember you telling me was about the handicap clinic and having some circular economy sort of system to that. And it intrigued me and has inspired me. And I've actually repeated that story many times because it's inspired me to open up a brand and a business based on the circular economy. And I don't think I've told you this, but I will tell you one day. But please do tell us about that story specifically. I really love the idea of the circular economy. In COVID, I wrote a book with a guy called Iraj Abedian, who wrote the Financial Constitution for South Africa. And he's chief economist for banks. And anyway, he's got his own business now. And the book that we wrote was really about the disparity of wealth and what a problem that is in the world, and hoping that COVID-19 would have helped to redirect it in some way. But we also spoke about the circular economy, and I researched the circular economy when I was writing that book as well. And then when you told me that story, it was such a full circle for me because it was a practical version of it. So please do go ahead and tell that story and give as much detail as possible, to be honest. It was a great story.
Well, interestingly, one of the patients of my clinics was a trustee on a nonprofit organization, and he was talking about some of the struggles they had as an organization to raise funds. And I went in as a volunteer to see if I could help them with some business ideas. And it became clear that they depended too much on donations. So we needed to create social economy to be able to generate revenue, to be able to fund the charity work. This was providing services of education and therapy to persons with disabilities. And I ended up spending so much time there. I went to the guys and I said, look, something has to give. You're either going to have to recruit someone to run this, you know, or you know, it's become too much. So they asked me if I actually would, you know, become the CEO of this organization, which was relatively small. And I said, as long as I can keep my clinics on the side and earn a revenue from there, because the charity obviously was limited in its funding, I'll come and give it a good shot. Anyway, long story short, over a few years, we grew the organization to what is now Malta's probably most reputable and large nonprofit organization called Inspire. And after years working in the organization and helping it grow, we are helping over 1,000 families at any point in time with therapy and education. We realized that we were taking these kids all the way from birth, diagnosed with autism or at birth, through to the 16 age where they were finishing secondary school, which is mandatory in Malta. But then stopping there was nothing to be able to help them move from there into employment or tertiary education. So I went to my board and I asked them if we should invest in developing programs around this, but they thought that it would be better that we would focus on what we're good at and we would continue to do what we were doing. So I started a new organization, which was called Empower, which basically took our graduates, you know, the people coming out of Inspire, and created a temp agency, but they were never temporary. They were always permanent, but we would find them work and we would place them within businesses where they would work in an open environment. So it wasn't a special center. It was literally in open employment where they had a job coach, where we worked very closely with the team of the client to make sure that they understood the particular needs of the individual and particularly their strengths and how they could tap into those strengths to bring the best out of that individual. They would be paid fairly, market rates, and we would make sure that they were, they were supported and they were given the right support to be able to thrive in that environment. Interestingly, we got to about 30 people, and this was an idea that had been started before my time, but we sort of tried to make it economically sustainable. So we renegotiated the agreements. We found ways to make sure that we were measuring performance effectively, that we were really creating value for the business, not so they weren't seen as a charity case, as, we're ticking a box by employing persons with disabilities. And this win-win really, really caught on. So the government came to me and said, can we do this on a national level? And so we created a foundation between the government and us where we now employ 700 odd persons with complex needs. Now we're also helping people with severe mental health issues, as well as disability and autism, communication problems, and other physical limitations. And we have about 50 job coaches that go around the country providing support to these individuals. They are generating wealth for their business, for the economy. They're earning, a decent wage, which allows them to be more independent. They have choices on where they work and how they develop. Some people are on a career progression because they have the skill set and they want to continue to grow. Other people are happy being part of a team and just look forward to getting out of bed in the morning instead of staying at home and vegetating. And it's really helped change the perception on a national level of persons with disabilities and their contribution to the economy.
Wow. You can see I couldn't even speak. That's fantastic. Can you just go back to the clinic itself and how you got it to fund itself? What was that model that you used? How did you go about doing that? Because you moved it from charity to a social economy. You called it a social economy, right? Another way of saying circular economy, or is there a difference there?
I think it's different. It's similar to social enterprise.
Yes.
So it's essentially creating something of value for society in a way that it generates revenue to sustain itself.
Right.
So everything's plowed back in.
Right.
Whereas circular economy, the way I understand it, is more transformative of resources that go back into the system.
Okay.
So in this case, what we were doing is we were looking at services we were providing families with children with different needs and monetized them for people who were, let's call them non-disabled. Yeah. So everybody else, basically.
Yes.
So let's take physiotherapy as an example. So we were providing physiotherapy for someone with cerebral palsy, helping them, stretch and move. We could use that physiotherapist to provide part of their day against payment to people who lived in the area of the clinic. And that money was enough to fund the free service we then gave persons with disabilities. That's one example. We had a lovely pool, which we opened for membership. We had gardens, which we opened on the weekend. We had a big car park, which we had, car boot sales and things like that. So we were generating revenue rather than going cap in hand to corporates and say, please give us money.
So there's multiple income streams that you were applying to be able to bring that into the social, the aspect. Okay, that's great. How involved are you in it right now?
I sit on the board and I'm quite involved in activities that relate to fundraising. But that's pretty much it. I sit on about 6 or 7 different charitable boards as an advisor. And I think that's probably where I can add most value. Although I do get stuck in if I need to and help with the fundraising efforts. I probably spend 10 to 20% of my time, on a voluntary basis or a pro bono basis, helping causes I believe in.
And you did some ultra marathons based on helping these people. So talk a little bit about that as well.
Well, my career in sports, hence why I became a physiotherapist, was in basketball. But after a career in basketball and...
What do you mean basketball, Nathan? I've stood next to you. You're not that tall, bro. And I'm short. What do you mean basketball? So what? Malta had a short basketball team? What are you talking about?
Yeah. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
I'm sure you can try. Yes. Fair, fair. Sorry about that. Yeah. Couldn't help myself. Yes.
No, good shot. I had a number of injuries, and I remember being at the surgeon who we became buddies. He saw me so much. Said, look, after these multiple surgeries and all that, he said, you need to tone down and do something else. And I I was doing my physio, my swimming and my cycling and my running. And I thought, oh, put those three together and that's a triathlon. So I said, I need something motivating. I can't just sort of sit on the bike and watch TV or Netflix while I'm on the treadmill, forget it. So I needed the challenge and I signed up for a triathlon. And funny story is that I obviously came out of the water last, struggled on my bike to keep up. But then on the run at the end, I started to catch people. And I thought, I know, I need a longer race so I have more time to catch up. And so I progressed from, the typical Olympic distance to the half Ironman, to the full Ironman, and then multiple Ironmans. I've always sort of seen, how far can I stretch it? Last man standing type of thing. I was never fast, but I just could, diesel engine, I could just keep going. So this fascination of how far I could push myself morphed itself then into trying other things. So I've done extreme swims. I've done sort of back-to-back marathons. I've done the Marathon de Sable in the desert. And it's always been around sort of, what's this going to feel like and what's going to happen after I'm completely exhausted and the legs can't move. When the light goes on, when the car's empty, we all know there's a bit more fuel. I'm interested in that space. I want to know what happens there.
Mm.
And the more people say that can't be done, the more it rubs me up the wrong way and I go have a go. But to talk about the marathon thing that you mentioned, which ties in with the charity, I wanted to raise awareness for the European Year of Volunteering 2011. And I decided to run a marathon in every European state, which is 27 countries. And logistically, it was going to be impossible to do these by flying up to each one and coming back down and the expense and all that. So I wondered if I could do them back to back. So in September in 2011, I ran my first marathon in Malta, flew to Helsinki, ran a marathon there, and made my way down through Europe in a camper van, going through 27 countries in 27 days back-to-back, running a marathon in each country, finishing in Cyprus.
I need to sit down after listening to that.
Wow.
So what do you do with all that energy now, Nathan? I mean, is that energy still rushing through you, or like... What's happening there with you now?
I've sort of moved. I mean, I enjoy the physical stuff, but I've really enjoyed, the mental exploration of things. I'm really curious to learn a little bit about how the mind works. And I've been experimenting with, basic things like mindfulness and meditation, but also how music affects the mind and how, external environment shapes the way that our personalities develop. So a lot of my time has been spent reading up and exploring and trying stuff there. But I'm still passionate about the outdoors. I want to be on my bike whenever I can or running. Every time I'm traveling, John, I take a day out after to explore. And if I'm in the mountains, I'm gonna find a lake to run around. And if I'm in Dubai, I'm going to get on my bike and go out to the desert and spend the day cycling. So I need that.
Yes.
That's my therapy, absolutely. I would say, rather than my sport.
I was actually reading one of these sort of also extreme endurance athletes, like a post about him. And he said the thing that made him good was that he was just better at suffering than everyone else. And I thought, it sounds very similar. Like when the gauge hits zero, it's like, how long can you keep going once it's hit that?
What's interesting, Eric, is that there's a point beyond that when the pain stops. And I've had situations where, you go into hallucinogenic states or semi-trance states or theta. And that's beyond.
While you're running.
Yeah. My longest run non-stop was 28 hours.
What?
And that was across the Dolomites.
That's insane.
And it was, wow. And again, at the end of it, you're in trance. You're in trance. It's a completely different state of mind.
Mm. How do you prepare for a race that's long? I mean, I know what the guys look like when they're training for Ironman, like a full Ironman. I know what that sort of training schedule looks like. But when you're going to be running for 28 hours straight, how do you even prepare for that?
There's an element of resilience. So you need to have, I think also with age, it's time on legs. There's the mental side, which is really around understanding when pain is just discomfort or pain is damaging, where you need to, say, if I keep pushing, I'm going to get really hurt, and knowing where that line is. But the only way you're going to find that out is by discovering that line. It's going past it. So you're not going to go from nothing to running for 28 hours. But you can't prepare. This was a 100-miler, and I've done a few of those 100-milers. You can't prepare for a 100-miler like you would normally prepare for a marathon, where you'd run nearly the distance. Mm. In these cases, you may run maybe half, which is a double marathon, as your longest run, and then you're going to have to run 168 or 169 kilometers on the day.
I recently listened to episode 2, season 7 of IRL podcast, and this one is called The Humans in the Machine. And I got to tell you, it was such an eye-opener because they were interviewing these young adults in Kenya that were actually the people inputting the information required for these large language models and having to deal with some hectic things on the internet. And they were showing that these big companies like Meta weren't really compensating these people for this incredibly difficult work. I mean, the psychological turmoil they must be going through must be really, really tough. I mean, it gave me such a new appreciation for what they're going through, and also to hold them more accountable as these big organizations make incredible profits without sharing it in a fair way. So search for Mozilla IRL in your podcast player or visit irlpodcast.org. We'll also include a link in the show notes for this pod. And many thanks for IRL for their support.
So let's move from this to what are you doing now as far as coaching is concerned, leadership, and also Vistage, right? So let's talk about your coaching practice and let us know what you've done with that coaching practice. You said you have a bunch of coaches working with you. What does that look like? What are you doing there? And then that's the first part. The second part is, what do you do around those leadership coaching sessions? Where are you? I mean, Eric is deep in the leadership work and works with the major organizations around South Africa around these things. So we'd love to get your take on both of those. So yeah, let us know.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of fell into this because I realized that whilst, you know, I had my business studies and I had experience, I lacked what I felt it took to be able to run an organization well. Leadership is a very holistic approach, you know, to being the persona, that the role model that you want to be or aspire to be. So I joined a peer group when I was young. I became a CEO at 26. And before after I was an entrepreneur and started to run larger organizations, I felt I needed to have wisdom around me. And I joined a peer group of CEOs and business owners that I felt would give me some experience. And I thrived. It allowed me to avoid the pitfalls and the potholes that, you know, they'd fallen into earlier in their careers. It allowed me to discern decision-making approaches instead of just the way I knew, and alternative ways to lead, alternative ways to grow businesses, but also other things in corporate governance or how to sell a business or how to internationalize. You know, I had no idea how these things worked. So for me, being in the presence of these people really helped. So what we then did, you know, as I became a coach, is I made sure that peer groups was going to be part of our repertoire. Vistage is a global organization of peer advisors, of peer group members, mostly CEOs and business owners, led by qualified and experienced chairs that operate in 35 countries. We have over 45,000 CEOs and business owner members. And I bought the license for Malta, which we grew, and now we moved into the Middle East, and later on we're expanding into the Middle East and also into Northern Europe. So my license, you know, allows me to bring in key people to chair groups and build groups, and find amazing CEOs and business leaders that have an open mind, that are happy to be vulnerable, to tell their story, to help other people, and to be made accountable to the group to get stuff done. In our CEOs, we are terrible procrastinators. We tend to focus on the things we like doing and push the stuff we don't like doing to next Monday. With a peer around you making sure you're dotting the I's and crossing the T's, you actually move much faster. So our businesses grow at least double the pace. Wow. That their industry would typically move at. Wow. Yeah, through this accountability. So it's actually proven to be a good business to be in. But frankly, I just love being in there. I chair 6 groups myself, and I'm a member of 2 others. So I spend a lot of my time in Vistage groups just because I love it. In fact, so much so that I've got CEOs to run my events business and our coaching practice and our training academy, because I don't want to do that. I just want to be in the room. So,
can you quickly outline just briefly what is the difference between Vistage and EO and YPO for those listening?
Sure. So EO tends to be entrepreneurs who are growing their business. They tend to be potentially smaller organizations compared to the other two cohorts. Vistage is small to medium enterprise, depending on the location you're in. In Malta, a small business in Dubai is a big business here. So, you know, it's relative. However, we're looking for the mindset of the individual who is either grown a number of businesses and is on their multiple, or is growing a business from a medium enterprise to a corporate. So okay. Those typically gravitate towards Vistage. YPO is somewhat similar. You will have big corporates there as well. You'll also have hired gun CEOs who are in YPO. On a international level, they're all great organizations. They're well run. Their focus is really developing the individuals within the groups or the forum, depending on which one you're choosing. Vistage is the largest from a headcount perspective, from a members globally. But that's mostly because they have big numbers in the US and the UK.
I was going to ask, what do you think is the draw card there? What draws people more to Vistage than to EO, for example?
I think the draw to all of them is that it's lonely at the top.
Yeah,
As business owners and leaders, we feel that we need to have people around us that can help guide and advise. Mm. So I think that's the driver for. I think business size does have an effect. From a membership cost perspective, they're much of a muchness, quite similar. So the financial barrier to entry is equal. I think then it's who your mates are. You know, who's in the room? Yeah. Do you know people there? Mm. You know, birds of a feather type of situation that typically leads people to move to one to the other.
Tell me, I heard that EO is self-driven, whereas Vistage hires people to come in, just like you said. Whereas EO like runs their own forums and runs their own. They've got their own leadership, leading people and learning people. Is that the same with Vistage, or do you hire people there?
So different licenses use different approaches. My approach is that we bring people in to chair, and these people are experienced business leaders who have been there and done that, and they help coach and mentor the members. EO is much more towards developing the individual to learn how to run a business. So there's a lot more, let's say, instruction with EO, which is probably required, and that's why people might join it. Mm. Whereas us, we tend to basically have conversations around experiences.
Great. Tell us, do you follow any sort of principle, or what sort of process do you follow when you're in the room and you're running those leaders' workshops and stuff like that? Just talk us through a little bit at that, because we both do that, Eric and I, but I guess in very different ways.
Yeah. So my favorite part of Vistage is what we call issue processing. So we have a methodology which we've been using for 65 years, which essentially asks the member who has an issue to process, and an issue may be an opportunity, it may be a challenge or a dilemma that they'd like the group to help them as a sounding board on. So it starts with framing the question. You know, what's the problem you're trying to solve? And there's some tweaking of that because people sometimes don't necessarily... Yeah, the wrong question. So there's clarifying questions from the group. You typically go round robin. Please explain what you mean by this. And is this really what it is, or is it something else? And after a couple of rounds, we hope that the member has actually framed the question properly. And it may be a question that needs resolving, or it may be a question that they need to go and find out more about. The chair in the room is making sure that everybody is part of the conversation. And that, more importantly, no one is giving advice, at least in the initial stages, because CEOs are brilliant at fixing problems. You tell me your question, I will give you the answer.
So are you talking about men?
For us CEOs? To bite our tongue and hold back. Yeah. We have a good CEOs. We have a good gender balance in our meetings.
Okay.
And the women are just as bad trying to fix problems, if not worse sometimes. You know, again, it's altruistic. We're trying to be helpful. You know, we're trying to be helpful by giving someone the answer, but that's not the solution. So we've understood what the real question is and we've talked around what the solutions might be, we ask the members to frame it in their voice. What would I do if I was in that situation? And they may speak from experience, or they just may be inspired by the conversation and take it forwards. And then it's up to the member to say, okay, I like what I've heard. I'm going to take a bit of this and a bit of that and go and apply it. It's up to the chair then to make that person accountable the next month to come back and tell the rest of the group what they've done about it and what worked and what didn't for us to learn from that person's endeavors. But also more importantly, to make sure that they got it done rather than just sort of, oh yeah, I got busy with work and I forgot about it.
Love it. I always love this approach where it's not explicitly telling someone what they should do, but giving them the space to, I guess, processing is the exact right word for this process that people are going through. You have an interesting vantage point because you get to be in groups, you get to be like heading them up, cheering them, but you also get to have the license and see across many different groups. Have you seen any specific patterns of what leaders are struggling with at the moment, like prominent themes that have emerged across all the groups?
Yes, absolutely. And there's two reasons to verify that. One is the anecdote, yes, what people are talking about in their groups, what are the issues they tend to be processing. But also we poll our members and ask them specifically, what are the things that are holding you back from growth? What are the things that you'd like to spend more money on and invest in? You know, what are the things you need to be careful about? And we call this the Vistage Confidence Index, which is a global index that goes around the 45,000 members for us to get a bit of a feel for what's going on the planet. The advantage of this is that CEOs have foresight. So we've tracked the confidence index against markets, and we've actually seen that CEOs are predicting the markets by 6 months collectively. Wow. So it's the wisdom of crowds with CEOs specifically who would be saying, well, I think I'm going to hold back because I'm unsure. And guess what? When CEOs around the world decide that, an economy slows down. But when they're gung-ho and they want to grow and they want to invest and they're going to recruit and they collectively have that mindset, it drives the economy. So polling the CEOs gives us as chairs an understanding of what we need to talk about, but it also gives us an understanding of where the economies are going. And this is a very, very powerful tool for Vistage members because it allows them to predict or plan, you know, their way forward. Current issues mainly is talent. You know, where do I find talent? How do I keep talent? How do I avoid the wage wars and create more value within the organization through culture to be able to get the right people there and maybe be a bit stickier? Around the world, except maybe in certain countries like Middle East, there's concerns around slowdown at the moment, you know, where the economy is going. You know, UK is suffering. US is leaning on the small to medium enterprise to help, you know, drive their economy at the moment. The big boys are struggling a little bit. So, you know, different regions will have different issues. And so then because we are regional, because we act locally, the conversations may be different in that sense from place to place. I think something that we're seeing more and more of, particularly post-COVID, is this concept of work-life balance, remote working, the way we operate, the way we do business. And again, different economies and different cultures do different things. But generally, I feel that most CEOs and business owners are more concerned about mental health and physical well-being for themselves and for their teams. So that's a good thing. The ESG movement is picking up globally. Hopefully, it isn't a greenwashing exercise, and you know we will see change in the way that you know we do business that is less harmful to the environment, more socially oriented, and you know with better governance, less corruption, and more transparency. So, I think these are the main topics that we're seeing within the business community, within the Vistage community.
Okay, where's AI?
It's very tough. Where's AI? That was my first comment. There's no AI anywhere there because we just hear AI all the time.
I think, you know, there was a bit of a, you know, it's still definitely a conversation. I think it's more around the practicality of it. You know, okay, we've talked about AI, and it's cool, but how do we actually use it? And there are some conversations around the ethics. John, I've heard you talk about this, you know, on stage around the ethics around AI and how do we use AI in a way that doesn't, that reflects the corporate governance element of ESG. So, the repercussion of AI across the business clearly is something that, that they talk about. But I think most CEOs are a little bit aloof on these things. You know, they tend to lean on their CTO to tell them, you know, what they need to do. So that's why perhaps it's not the most important thing on the CEO's mind.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, the ESG thing has got such a bad rep out there. What's the on the ground story? Because, you know, the organization first and foremost must be profitable to the shareholders and then must be ESG driven, which kind of makes ESG irrelevant. It's almost like the structure has to change and the appetite of shareholders has to change in order to be able to bring the second layer of measuring success in a new way. And it seems like it's in dichotomy with each other.
Mm. I think there is an element of chicken and egg here. I think that if you look at corporates that have lived 50 years or plus, they tend to be the ones that care more about their employees and less about their shareholders, more about their customers than making profit. And so these are, you know, this is another iteration of what was previously CSR or corporate responsibility. Yes. Or doing good business. So, you know, it's a fad. It's like, you know, the next type of workout, you know, it changes. Yes. All the time. But it's a label that we need to have so that we can have the common conversation.
Yes.
My belief is that, you know, sustainability is going to be more important simply because the new workforce is much more inclined to look at why. Yes. You do what you do rather than just what you do and how much money you make. And this is going. Yeah. To be important. So if we don't, you know, call it ESG, call it something else, if we don't have organizations with purpose, we're not going to be able to recruit the right talent because they don't want to work for companies that are greenwashing or, you know, causing. Yeah. Damage to the planet. So whether you're doing. Yes. It from a cynical perspective or, you know, to, yes. To pretend to attract those people or you genuinely believe it, like Patagonia and those, you're going to have to adopt it. So I think, you know, adopting it to stay in relevant and stay in business is a requirement. Doing it because you actually want to and believe in it is even better.
Well, look, I think we need to be able to use more examples than Patagonia. We all go back to Patagonia. It seems like to be the anchor point of them giving up $10 million back to Trump to fight again. I mean, nobody's doing that really. And you know, it's far too few, but it's great that it's up there and it's part of the conversation. Absolutely.
Yeah. But I think, John, for me, it's about leadership. So, you know, the example we gave of where, you know, me and my colleagues set this organization to employ persons with disabilities, you can do it from. Yes. A charitable perspective, but you can actually do it from an economic perspective. Because the more we take people off, you know, the dole or whatever, the pension that they've got, and they can start to earn a living rather than get handouts, the more independent they become. And hopefully they end up paying taxes and contributing to the economy. So,
yes.
You know, we can be cynical and say, yeah, people really do it just because they want to help, or people do it because they want to look good. But actually, if it has a good social element, it typically makes economic sense.
Okay. That's really good to know. I'm very happy to hear that. So, Eric, I think we've got running out a bit of time. Do you have any last questions?
Yeah, well, I was wondering, like, you know, working with all these leaders, what is the main thing that you are currently addressing with them? Like, you know, apart from the vestige stuff that's happening, when you are sitting in sessions, what is the main thing that you are talking about?
I think it's the balance between delivering the value now in the short term and thinking more sustainably about the future. And how do you balance that? You know, and again, it affects our philosophy of life. Do you live in the moment? Do you live in the past? Do you live in the future? And how do you balance that? How do you shift and not get stuck in any one of those? The exigencies on a CEO today is so, it's huge. You know, CEOs are making decisions with 10% of the information they need to make the correct one. They have to lean on their teams. So it's really about empowering their teams and building talent and attracting, you know, the right people to be able to build trust within those teams. So a lot of it really is around reiterating the point that a leader is a person, is a human being, and has to have community to be able to thrive and be successful. And again, to not do it alone, you know, because you make mistakes. If you don't have a sounding board, if you don't have like-minded people around you, you get blind spotted.
Mm. When I just started this thing recently called Leadership Lab, where we just bring leaders together just to, exactly to what your point was a bit earlier, is that it's so lonely to be at the top. And often, you know, you don't know who to share that with. Like, who do you share this journey with? And so it was great to have people like realizing that there's a sharing of shared experiences. That was great. But the thing that I spoke about in that session was that there's a burden of leadership that we don't often talk about.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, most of what leadership is about is glorifying leaders. And it's so amazing to be a leader and everyone should be a leader. And like your position doesn't define you as a leader. And like, it's all about the glorification of it. But we forget that it's a there's a burden that comes with it as well, which is that
100%.
You're responsible for so much and yeah. and all fingers point to you if things go wrong. And I think what makes leaders incredible then is their willingness to accept that burden. But then you still need a space to go in and share that burden. So yes. I think the work that you do is incredible.
Eric, I agree. And you know what for me is sad is that, and I think John will resonate from our conversations, business should be fun. You know, it there are times when it's stressful and there are times when things don't go your way. But in general, it should be enjoyable. You should wake up and want to go to work because it should be fun. It should be, you know, the challenge, the experiences that you get, the personal growth from saying yes to accepting that responsibility you talked about. The fact it's a burden and we perceive it as a burden, which is true, is a pity. You know, we should be able to celebrate, the life that we live because we are building teams, we're helping people grow, we're delivering value to customers. You know, there's a lot of positivity, but we tend to magnify the negatives. And I think it's, you know, it's a sign of the times as well. We moan a lot, we complain a lot, we don't particularly celebrate the wins. We focus on the losses.
Just the grind, yeah.
Yeah, and the grind. And we've sort of glorified this grind. Yeah, work hard to achieve. You know what? It shouldn't be an up. You know, we're not Sisyphus. It shouldn't be an uphill slog to be able to get success.
I watched this TikTok and the guy was saying, I will not give you 100% at work because nothing works at 100% all the time. I'll give you 60% and I want to chill the other time. I want to have another life, you know. I guess bringing in the smartest talent needs to give people that sort of leeway to live a more balanced life so that there is an access to a different type of creativity rather than just this addiction to drive and stress, which is kind of what we've all made out is what work should be. Nathan, last question.
Yeah, I think we need to stop.
Go on. No, go on.
I was going to say we just stop measuring with time. Yes. You know, work-life balance isn't a time measurement. It's not time, but I need three hours of work and 4 hours of this. It's value. You know, you know, most CEOs can do their job, which is strategy, in a half the time they spend at work. Yes. But they still need to hang out and be seen.
Yes, exactly. Mm. There is still that old check-in, check-out kind of system. Yes, there is, especially in the Middle East. There's a lot of that still.
Mm. I also saw a TikTok of like 2 days ago where the guy, all this dude does is he reads texts from like horrible bosses essentially. And so the guy was like, so the boss is mentioning the dude. He's like, hey, I'm going to be docking like a couple of hours off your work and like you'll be receiving less pay next week. The guy's like, what? Like how? He's like, no, I noticed that your activity on your computer hasn't been what it's supposed to be. It's like, what do you mean? He's like, oh no, like we've tracked and we can see your mouse is standing still for prolonged periods of time and therefore we're assuming you're not doing the work and therefore we're docking your hours off. And the guy's like, what? Like, so much for trust in this business. Like,
what you get then is somebody who creates some mechanical arm that moves the mouse every 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Such a ridiculous way to measure any impact. The final question, Nathan, and thank you so much for your time again for being with us, is what does an expansive life look like to you? And what else do you need to do to make your life even more expansive? What is the accountability that you require to take that next step?
Really good question, and you know, unprepared. I would say it's a life of possibilities and creativity. It's exploring, it's adventuring. It's saying, oh, what would, you know, would this work? Could I try this? What would it feel like if I did this or that? And I happen to be at a time in my life, although I've always been that way. I get bored very quickly, where we're expanding both the business and our team. In different regions, learning new cultures, meeting new people, having great conversations. So I'm in a really good place today if I had to say about expansion, both from a realistic perspective of we're expanding the business, but also I feel that I've grown. I've grown as a person, I've grown as a leader, just by going through this experience of you know, spreading beyond the tiny island of Malta over the last sort of 5 to 6 years. So what accountability do I need? I need to self-reflect. You know, sometimes I'm sitting on that plane and I'm going, why the hell am I doing this? and I miss my training session because I have early morning meetings because of time zones and all this stuff. I just need to make sure that I get in the helicopter every now and then and understand the lay of the land and why I'm doing it and reminding myself of the purpose of this. And that just sort of keeps me on the track.
Yeah, that's really great. I wasn't supposed to ask another question, but do you have a coach?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Good. So I'm part of two Vistage groups. We have one which is between chairs. So all great people. We sort of coach each other. And I also have my old coach who was the coach of my first group. And I still refer to him and meet him whenever I can.
Wow. Fantastic. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time, Nathan. It's been really great to hear your perspective and for you to share it with us and our listeners. For the listeners out there, thank you so much for joining us for another podcast. Nathan, where can people find out more about you and connect with you?
So LinkedIn is probably the easiest, Nathan Faruja. An easy website to remember is upyourlevel.com. And I'm there. That's one of our businesses. Yes. That's the training academy. And that's the easiest way to get to me, upyourlevel.com or LinkedIn.
That's right. I remember actually looking at Up Your Level. And I see you on LinkedIn, very busy sharing and meeting all sorts of people around the world. I look forward to bumping into you real soon. And Eric, nice to see you again. And Nathan, we'll chat to you soon. To everybody else out there, ciao.